Good evening. Good to see you, folks. We are in the third teaching on the prophecies of Balaam. So if you will turn to Numbers chapter 24, we're going to cover from verse 15 on through chapter 25. As we have seen so far in the three prophecies that Balaam has given, they are all three and have all three been in favor of the Israelites. We saw that in chapters 22 all the way through the first part of 24. Just a little recap in case you guys don't know. A guy by the name of Balak was the king of the Moabites. At the time, he saw what Israel had done when they came into the land with the Amalekites, and he was a little bit freaked out. He saw that they were millions in number. He knew that he couldn't fight them strategically, and so basically he called upon this prophet, and I put prophet in quotes because I'll let you guys decide whether you think he's a true prophet or not, but he called upon this prophet, and he basically asks him to come into his country and pronounce a curse upon the Israelites. And as he comes in and he sees the Israelites, each time he pronounces a blessing instead of a curse. And you might remember that the Lord told him, first of all, not to go. He went ahead and went anyway. And on the pathway there, when he was going, his donkey saw that the Lord was standing in the path trying to prevent him. He didn't see him, but the donkey did. So he goes ahead, and when he goes, each time the Lord says, finally, he knows he's going to go anyway. So he says, you know, go, but only speak what I tell you to speak. Don't speak anything else. So each time he opens his mouth to try to pronounce a curse that he's kind of been paid to pronounce, out comes a blessing because God's warned him, you say what I tell you to say and nothing else. So even though he's been hired by Balak to pronounce a curse, he really can't do it. And each time Balak gets more and more frustrated. And you might remember we left off with him taking him from mountain to mountain to mountain to try to get the Lord to change his mind. You know, he thinks if I can give him a different vantage point, then maybe the Lord will pronounce the curse. And up to this point, in all three of these, he's not been able to do this. So let me read something to you in 24, and then we'll get started in the rest of the chapter. In chapter 24, verses 10 through 14, it says, "Then Balak's anger burned against Balaam, and he struck his hands together, and Balak said to Balaam, 'I called you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have persisted in blessing them these three times. Therefore, flee to your place now. I said I would honor you greatly, but behold, the Lord has held you back from honor.'" Isn't that always the Satan's ploy? We always think we've missed something. You know, to be honored by a pagan is not necessarily honor. To get riches and fame at the house of someone who doesn't, I mean, at the hands of someone who doesn't know the Lord can be fleeting at best. Today, so many times we're looking for accolades and money and fame and fortune, and the world, Satan, I don't think is too bothered with giving that to people who will sell their souls. I think if you sell your soul to the enemy, he'll let you have a certain amount of fame and a certain amount of fortune, but you got to remember the price that you're going to pay is way too high. You know, eternal separation from God. He basically says, because you've done this, you've been stripped of the honor. God forbade you to do this. You can't have the honor now and the fame and the glory. And Balaam said to Balak, "Did I not tell your messengers whom you had sent to me, saying, though Balak were to give me his house full of gold and silver, I could not do anything contrary to the command of the Lord, either good or bad, of my own accord. What the Lord speaks, I will speak. And now behold, I'm going to my people. Come, I will advise you what these people will do to your people in the days to come." Now, if we could all keep the same heart and attitude with what he said, but not necessarily what's hidden in his heart. When he says, you know what? I can neither speak good nor bad except what God gives me to speak. Whatever God gives me to speak, that is what I will speak. Wouldn't it be nice if we could really honestly do that? We wouldn't open our mouth unless the Lord told us to. And we opened it up, we'd say the things he wants us to say instead of saying whatever, you know, comes up, comes out kind of thing. Just say and do what the Lord would have us do. I want you to make particular note of what he says in verse 14. At the end of it, "I will advise you what these people will do to you in the days to come." Now, chapter 25, we're going to see some of the results of that advice. But first, we got to take a look at the rest of chapter 24 and look at Balaam's fourth prophecy. Pretty amazing prophecy when we strip it down. Look at verse 15. He took up his discourse and said, "The oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eyes is opened." Boy, he's sure setting himself up to be somebody, isn't he? I mean, take a look at his own introduction of himself. "The oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eyes is open, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down yet having his eyes uncovered." You know, that's quite a self-announcement, don't you think? That's kind of quite an introduction that he gives himself there. In verse 7, he says, "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob, a scepter shall rise from Israel, and shall crush through the forehead of Moab, and tear down all the sons of Sheth. Edom shall be a possession, Seir its enemies, also will be a possession, while Israel performs valiantly. One from Jacob shall have dominion, and will destroy the remnant from the city." And he looked at Amalek and took up his discourse and said, "Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end shall be destruction." Remember, it's not how he starts, how you finish. He was the first one of the first ones to settle in that area, but he's going, you know what? He's going down. You know, he's not gonna last, because Israel is going to perform valiantly. Verse 21, "And he looked at the Kenite, and he took up his discord and said, 'Your dwelling place is enduring, and your nest is set in the cliff. Nevertheless, Cain will be consumed. How long will Asher keep you alive?' Then he took up his discourse and said, 'Alas, who can live except God has ordained it?'" This is really interesting, isn't it? Kind of gives you a different perspective on life and death, doesn't it? We think if we're going to eat enough vitamins, if we're going to, you know, run on the treadmill enough. Now, please don't get me wrong. I do think that we can kind of live healthy or not live so healthy. But bottom line is, life and death is in the hands of God. That's where it needs to be. I don't think life and death was ever meant to be in the hands of people. I mean, I know that God's given authority and he's given the death penalty in some cases. But I think life and death is meant to stay in God's hands, not in our hands. But it says, "Who can live except that God ordains it? But ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, and they shall afflict Asher and afflict Eber, so they also will come to destruction." Then Balaam arose and departed and returned to his place, and Balak also went his way. Now, guys, in a nutshell, Balaam's fourth prophecy is telling Balak, the king of Moab, that Israel's going to rule. I mean, if you take that all down and you take a look at the different tribes and different people that he's going to have victory over, the bottom line is he's saying that Israel is going to rule. And not only is he telling Balak, the guy that hired him, he's telling him that not only will his kingdom be consumed, but so will anybody else who comes up against Israel. I think it's a dangerous thing to mess with God and mess with God's kids. And I think that we're going to see here that as long as his kids are doing what he wants him to do, he's on, he's on their side. I think God's on our side, whether we're always doing what he wants us to do or not. It's just that he's able to show himself strong on the behalf of those who stay on his side, those who let him be on his side. It's kind of like those of you that have kids, you're on your kid's side all the time, but sometimes you just can't bless them because they're on the wrong side, if that makes any sense. You're always on their side, but sometimes that path of blessing that you want to pour out on them is broken by their disobedience, or it's broken by their sin. Some of the things that you want to do for them, you can't do. I can't remember how many times, and as a father and raising kids, that sometimes I wanted to do something for one of my kids, and because of something they did, I couldn't. Because it would have been interpreted as a reward for bad behavior. So I had to back up and not do the very thing that I wanted to do for them. And sometimes I couldn't even tell them about it, because that's just rubbing salt in the wound. You know, you wanted to tell them, "Hey, I wanted to do this for you. I wanted to be a blessing for you, but I can't." And so basically God is saying, Israel is going to consume them and any of the other nations that come up against them. But I want you to take a look at verse 17 for a moment. We really that this to me, especially in light of the resurrection, this is really awesome. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come from Jacob, and a scepter shall rise from Israel. Star, scepters, this has to do with royalty, guys. This has to do with princes and kings. Now, this is a verse you're used to hearing at Christmas time, talking about Jesus being the star. Have you ever wondered how those wise men from the east, some 1,500 years before this prophecy, knew where to look for baby Jesus? By the way, some commentators believe that there was more like 300 wise men than three. I mean, we traditionally have heard three wise men. But I want you to stop and think about it. Three mystic wise men following a star might not have caused too much of a stir. But you get 300 of them coming in, following a star, looking for the next king. That's going to mess Herod up. That's going to be noticeable. That's something he's going to be aware of, and it definitely caught his attention. How did they know to associate the star with the king born in Israel? How did they put this all together? Well, guys, evidently the words of Balaam's prophecy were written down, and evidently they were preserved for a very, very long time. Balaam was from the east, same place the wise man came from. You couple that with Daniel's prophecy about the 70 weeks, and you know that the 70 weeks had to do with the timing of everything. So if you take the timing and you couple it with this prophecy about the star and the prediction of a king born to Israel, these guys were smart enough to put it all together, and they knew exactly where to look, they knew what to look for, and they knew exactly when to look. Now, it's interesting in view of this character, Balaam. This amazing prophecy that came forth from him, accurate. Excuse me, by which later the wise men are drawn to Bethlehem, the land of Judea, to find Jesus, the Messiah, born as a baby. Just amazing stuff. Now, what you're going to see in the next chapter, in my opinion, makes it even more amazing. Look at chapter 25, verses 1 through 3. While Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods. And the people ate, and they bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. Now, when you see that phrase where the people ate and bowed down, that's kind of a term for an all-inclusive compromise. They broke bread with them. The men of Israel slept with the daughters of Moab. Now, you might be asking, well, what does this have to do with Balaam? Wasn't his prophecies over? And didn't he return to his own hometown? Well, the answer is yes. But I want to remind you of chapter 24, verse 14. Remember when we put some time and effort into that? He says, I'm going to my people now, but I will advise you what these people will do to your people in the days to come. God had given him a pretty clear vision of what was going to go down and that Israel was going to be victorious. But in the process, he saw something else. He saw a way to weaken the children of Israel. He saw a point of vulnerability. He saw a point of compromise. How do I know this? Well, we got the book of Revelation chapter 2. So keep your thumb there. Turn to Revelation chapter 2, verses 12 through 14. And to the angel of the church in Pergamum write, the one who has the sharp-edged sword says this, I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, and you hold fast to my name, and you did not deny my faith even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. Here it is, but I have a few things against you. You guys remember that section of Revelation there where he calls up all the seven churches and he gives them a report card to the church in Pergamos or Pergamum. He's saying, you know, I know you live right there in the cradle of Satan, but he says, you've managed to keep some things together, but here's the one thing that I have against you. Because you have some there who hold the teaching of, guess who? Some who hold the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit acts of immorality. So, the book of Revelation tells us that this guy did a little bit more than telling them what was going to befall them, what was going to become of them, what was going to happen to them in the future if they came up against Israel. He also decided to let them know how they could get the best of Israel. Balaam is indeed one of the most, in my opinion, paradoxical creatures, characters in the Word of God. You kind of don't know whether to take him serious as a real prophet or not to take him serious as a real prophet. And you know what? As you go through the commentaries and listen to the different commentators, you can see that they don't either. They're not sure what to make of him either. One will say he was definitely pagan, definitely occultic, definitely getting his power and his resources from the occult. And then you have this beautiful prophecy about the Messiah coming out of it. Well, that shouldn't surprise us. Satan's aware of the Messiah, isn't he? Satan knows a little bit about what's going on. He fears and trembles. Even the demons shudder at the name of Jesus. So I'm not going to try to tell you he is or he isn't from God. I'll be honest with you, I don't know. I have my own opinion on it, but I think we're going to have to go through the rest of this for you guys to make your own opinion on it. He was told to bless Israel and to not curse them. Four times he followed through with four blessings and even this prophecy regarding the Messiah. And even just before the fourth prophecy, he had told Balak in chapter 12 through 13, "Did I not tell your messengers? Did I not say, I can't speak anything good or bad. I can only speak the command that comes from God. Whatever God says, that's what I'll speak. I'll do what the Lord wants me to do." And yet, here in Revelation 2:14, it shows us that evidently Balak's promise of riches and fame got the best of him. We like to think that we're above this, don't we? As Christians, have you ever thought, man, I couldn't be tempted by money? Come on. You know how many Christians play the lottery? Why do we pay the lottery? Well, so I can tithe big when I strike it rich. I can pay off the Sunday school department, and we have all kinds of reasons, don't we? But the bottom line is we want the dough. The thought of having a couple million dollars is intoxicating, isn't it? Get-rich schemes are so alluring and so attractive. That's why these pyramid schemes, Shackley and Amway and all these other ones are so appealing. And I don't mean to step on anybody's toes if you're a distributor. That's fine. But I remember years ago, we got into both of them at one time thinking, I'm going to get rich. Because that's what we were told. We're going to get rich. Of course, we had all the reasons. We're going to be godly people, even though we're rich. And we're going to give money to the church. And we're going to do things for God. And maybe we would have, maybe we wouldn't have. But the bottom line is we wanted to have money. And evidently, the thought of this got the best of him. And even though he went back home, as he began to roll it around inside of his head and he thought of all that he had lost, all that money, all that fame, all that fortune, because Balak had basically promised to make him kind of second in charge. He said, "I'll elevate your name in the kingdom. Everybody will know who you are. I'll give you money beyond anything you could imagine." And evidently it got to rolling around inside of his head. So he told Balak the best way to get to Israel. Now he knew he couldn't get to him in war. He knew that he could not defeat him in war, outnumbered. And he could not defeat them because God's hand of blessing was upon them. So whether it had been outnumbered or not, God is a majority. So even if there had been few, they would have still been victorious because they had God's hand of blessing upon them. So Balaam's logical conclusion is this. Guys, this is really important. I hope you get this point, even if you didn't hear anything else I've said so far. And that is Balaam's conclusion, he began to rationalize in his mind, where's the weak point? How do we get this? Well, here's his conclusion. If God is strong on their behalf, it's because they're righteous. So if we can take away their righteousness, then God will not be pleased with them. So here was his conclusion. If they sin against God, then God will lift his hand of blessing from them and they will become vulnerable. And the fruit of that is what we see in the next three verses of chapter 25. By the way, I believe his counsel is straight from the pit of hell. I believe that whether he has heard from God or not, what he hears now is coming from another source. Here's his counsel. Bring in the prostitutes, infiltrate the camp, and water down their belief system. And their God will be upset with them. Their God will turn their back on them, and they will become weak, and you will be victorious. Well, that's pretty much what they did, and they did it with great success. Look at verses 4 through 9. And the Lord said to Moses, take all of the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor. Now, guys, Baal of Peor, right? Important to remember, but bottom line is, it's not God. If you can't remember the name, it's okay. It's not God. It's a false god. And anything that's not God is false. Anything that's not from God's hand is false. Anything that's not blessed of God is cursed of God. So there you have it. They have joined themselves to another god. They're worshiping another god, the god of this world, which we know we can take the chain of command. Remember, we've been talking about authority in Romans. You can take that chain of command back to Satan, the god of this world. They're worshiping another god, and that god is Satan. Verse 6, so they started out with God, and now they're slowly but surely compromising because of these things. Verse 6, then behold, some of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, while they were weeping at the door of the tent of meeting. Now, guys, I don't know if you catch this, or it's kind of hard to catch it in the way it's phrased, but he kind of brought his shack up to them. This is what it means. This curse has been pronounced, and he has the brashness, the boldness, while they're standing at the doorway of the tent of meeting, weeping for what is going on, he kind of trots up with his little Midianite gal. Sin makes you stupid. Sin causes you to lose your ability to think. You know, it causes you to lose your sensitivity to the things of God. If this guy would have been walking with the Lord, he would have never considered anything like this. I've seen it happen, guys. I've seen people walking with the Lord one year, and the next year, they almost are not hearing anything from God because sin has entered into their life. They've allowed someone or something to enter into the camp, and they've compromised on the things of God, and now they don't hear from the Lord anymore. Things that used to be so obvious to them, they're not even getting anymore. It's like short-circuited, their connection between them and their God. Verse 7, when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation. He took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent, and he pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through the body. So the plague of the sons of Israel was checked. Those who died by the plague were 24,000 people. The indication here, too, and I don't want to be too graphic, the indication is he took his Midianite woman back to the tent for you know what. And this guy by the name of Phinehas says, you know what? This is ridiculous. And he stood up and he took action. This is real righteous indignation. Now, boy, righteous indignation and just plain being mad, those are two things that are tough to sort out. But Phinehas somehow figured it out. You know what? Today, you know what we would have been doing? Worrying about a lawsuit. We would have been worrying about what somebody was going to say, or the friend of the Midianite woman, or the mother of the brother of the somebody, and we'd have had to have a committee meeting to figure out if this was politically correct and okay, or spiritually the impact it was going to have on the church and the congregation. And you know what? Nobody would have done anything about it. This man and his Midianite woman would have just moved to another congregation and continued on with their sin. Phinehas was a man who said, you know what? This is not right. And he did something about it, pretty severe something about it. Whew. Satan is very, very clever. He's been using the same tactics for centuries. And you know why? Because they work. Why change a plan if it's always effective? Now, you would think, now I know people are compared to sheep, and sheep are not the brightest animal in the barn. But you would think after centuries, after centuries, after centuries of the same kind of things, we would get a little smarter. But we don't. Because sin is always cloaked in deception. You guys have heard me say, Satan never comes out in the little red suit with the fork tail and the pitchfork. If he did, we would see him and go, uh-uh, not me. I ain't have nothing to do with you. He comes in the form of adultery. Midianite women, blonde hair and blue eyes, tall, dark, and handsome. He's not stupid. It's either right or it's wrong. No place in between. It's either right or it's wrong. It's either what God has asked us to do and told us what to do, or it's not. God does not negotiate on his principles. They're non-negotiable. Compromise. Here's another one that, if you're taking notes, get this one. Compromise is always a killer of righteousness. Compromise is always a killer of righteousness. And as a result of that, the blessings of God. The ability to hear from God. The ability to stand under the spout where his glory is coming out. But one thing that Balaam did not take into account, even in the midst of all this, one of the things he did not take into account, he did not take into account the grace of God. Because you see, he didn't know God on an intimate level, I'm convinced of that. He may have been used of God. He may have had some gifts. God may have given him a little something. But he did not have a close, intimate relationship with Jesus, with God, because if he had, he couldn't have betrayed God's people. So because of not having that close, intimate relation with God, he did not understand the grace of God, that unmerited favor of God, that he loves us unconditionally. Yes, sometimes we mess up and it has to be taken care of, but God never stops loving us. God is always there to say, "You're forgiven." If we'll just turn around and ask. God is always there to say, "Hey, let's get up and try it again," if we're willing to get up. In verse 10. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel with my jealousy." Remember, God's jealousy is not like our jealousy. It's that word's almost an unfortunate translation. Our jealousy is mixed with selfishness and pride and ego and everything else. God is God. God's always right. God loves us. His jealousy, when spoken of, is more the kind of knowing what's best for us and wanting to bless us and seeing us get cut off. Seeing us miss that. It would almost be the same phrase you might use with your kids. You're jealous of your kids. Well, that doesn't quite fit. How about protective of your kids? How about loving of your kids? How about forgiving of your kids? How about wanting the best for your kids? You see, you put all those together, and that's what we're talking about with God. And he indeed knows what's best for his kids. We don't always. We think we do, but we don't always. He always does. Verse 12, "Therefore say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his descendants after him a covenant of perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the sons of Israel. Now the name of the slain man of Israel who was slain with a Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of a father's household among the Simeonites." A leader. Satan always wants to get the leaders. You attack the shepherd, the sheep scatter. And that doesn't mean me, that means you. You're the shepherd of your household. God's going to try to attack your marriage. He's going to try to attack you in your personal fidelity, in your personal integrity, in who you are at the core. And any little amount that he's able to compromise, he's patient. He'll work a lifetime on trying to get us to compromise even the very little things so that the relationship that we had with God yesterday is not as strong today. And he'll just keep on working that day after day after day after day in our life. And if we're not careful, little things, little bitty things will creep in. Things that you and I might not think are any big deal, but they begin to creep in and they begin to compromise us. A little lie here. A little lie there. A little cheating of our time schedules at work here and a little cheating there. It's so easy for us, isn't it? We just don't think that those are big deals. And in the world's eyes, they're not. But for a man or woman of God, those little things mean a lot because we represent a great God. The enemy wants us to compromise. Here he took a leader of the children of the Simeonites. This wasn't just a bum. This was a leader. You can cause a leader to fall. You can cause hundreds, if not thousands, of people under the leader to fall, can't you? The name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cosby. No relationship to the real Cosby. The daughter of Zur, who was, listen, look at this. Look who she is. She's not just a nobody either. Who was the head of the people of a father's household of Midian. She was one of the big wigs of the Midianites. Her father was a big wig in Midian. Maybe they told themselves, hey, it's love. It's real love. She's really cute. He's really cute. We both have money. We're both popular. We're both famous. We're both leaders. It's okay. We're not just nobody. We're somebody. So therefore, it's okay for us because we're somebody. I remember a few years ago when Jimmy Swaggart fell, he and several other guys, basically, consistent theme with each one of those guys, Baker, the consistent theme was, they said, we got to the point where we thought we were so important, we could do what we wanted to do. We had so much power and we had so much money. We figured we had a direct connection with God because we wouldn't be blessed like we were unless we had a direct connection with God. So therefore, we had the right to do whatever we felt led of God. Loss of accountability. Satan loves to get us away from the rest of the flock. He loves to get us away from hearing messages. He loves to get us away from the fellowship and the accountability of having someone say, hey, how you doing in your walk? And guys, I don't want to be legalistic here, but let's put all this kind of together. Is there any TV show more important? Really, if you stop and think about it, is there any TV show that's more important than the things of God? No. Remember a few years ago when ER was popular? You know, depending on what night of week it was like, I think it came on like right at the end of the service. You'd look up and 15, 20 people be gone. It's like the end of the service. No fellowship for me, man. ER's on in 5 minutes. For Pete's sake, I'll buy you a recorder. And then you can watch it later. But isn't it funny how the enemy starts working on us? Oh, it's not going to matter. It's, you know, it's not legalism. And, you know, I'm not under the law. I have the liberty and the freedom. Yes, of course we do. But let me ask you this. Would the path of blessing been cut off with your children if they said, hey, I'm under grace, Mom and Dad. I don't have to do anything you ask me to do. I'm under grace, man. Don't lay that trip on me. You're being legalistic. Mow the yard, trim. I mean, you know, clean my... You're bumming me out. You know, you're really bumming me out with this legalism. I'm going to go find parents that are full of grace. Here's your bag. Hope you find them. You see, you wouldn't have bought that because you would have known the bottom line is that would have not been good for your child. you know that as that child matures and grows, they're going to need to face responsibilities. They're going to need to be a productive citizen, and some of that is learning how to do the things that are necessary to stay in the path of blessing. So you did everything you could to keep your children in the path of blessing, and as much as you tried, you still couldn't. Sometimes you still had to withhold the blessing you wanted to give them because you couldn't reward them. Sometimes we start with just a little bitty thing, a little bitty compromise, and then left unchecked, it's kind of like an infection. It just begins to grow and begins to grow. And you know what's amazing? Everybody around us can see it but us. Everybody else can see the compromise but us. Everyone else can see the game and the charade, but we can't. We think we got everybody snowed, like the man who brought his Midianite lover before the children of Israel when they were standing at the gate of the tabernacle, the door of the tabernacle, weeping over the sins of Israel. Immune. Everybody else can see it, but we can't because we've lost the connection. Boy, we're in such danger at that point. So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 17, be hostile towards the Mennonites. And the Mennonites. Oh, boy. Sorry, Jerry and Diana Ash, wherever you're at. They used to be Mennonites. Midianites. Midianites. You know, in the Old Testament, there's a lot of ites. There's a lot of ites, so you can get them mixed up. God was not asking them to be hostile towards the Midianites. So it was the Midianites, and he said, I want you to be hostile towards them and strike them. Verse 18, for they have been hostile to you with their tricks with which you have deceived, they have deceived you in the affair of Peor and the affair of Cosby, the daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister who was slain on the day of the plague because of Peor. So guess what? The grace of God. You're going, how is this the grace of God, 24,000 people? Well, it could have been all of them. I don't get it, Pastor. You and I always have a chance along the timeline to repent and get things right with God before we lose it all. God's always speaking. God's always trying to get our attention. And he's always saying it to us. And you know what? Sometimes we just blow it off and we ignore it and we ignore it and we ignore it. And I've seen people ignore it so much that it gets to the point where they lose everything. Everything they ever loved, everything they ever counted on, everything they ever desired and wanted, it's gone. They've lost their family. They lose it all. And so many times along the way, God was saying, hey, I don't want you to lose this. I want to bless you. I want to bless you. I want to pour out my blessing upon you, but you got to get this together. So, after the 24,000, atonement is made because one man had the boldness to stand up and say, this is wrong. Let's take care of it. So he took care of it, and God's forgiveness was granted. And after that, look what he tells him to do. Now get up and go do what I ask you to do. Now get up and go wipe out the Midianites. You've dealt with the issue. Get up and let's get to work. That's God's grace. That's God's grace. We're all human and we're all sinners and we're all saved by God's grace, but we got to deal with the sin in our life. And when we do, God says, okay, it's all forgiven. Now let's get up and get back in the race and let's finish the race. Let's do what I've asked you to do. Oh, by the way, Zimri and Cosby go down in the history books as the Romeo and Juliet of sin and compromise. Boy, how would you like to have your name written in a book that's going to last forever for this kind of sin? Also, how about Balaam? What ends up happening to Balaam, this quasi-prophet? Well, you're going to see in Numbers 31, verse 8, they kill the kings of Midian along with the rest of their slain, Evi and Rechem and Zur and Hur and Reba and the five kings of Midian. Here it is. They also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. He would have been better off speaking what God said to speak and no more. Saying what God asked him to speak and no more. Remember this, guys, as we close. By the way, if you want to follow this up with some supplemental devotional material tonight, go home and read 2 Peter chapter 2. Kind of read the whole chapter and you'll see it deals with compromise. and folks that compromise and the trouble they get into and the trouble that they cause. But remember this, guys, in closing. Compromise comes in many forms. But I can tell you this, because I've heard it at every conference I've ever been to, at every pastor's conference I've ever been to. It will come in three main categories in your life. And that will have to do with sex, money, and fame. No matter what the compromise is, it will have to do with one of those three things. You'll be able to put it in one of those three classifications.